This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today on Food Friday, we've got a historical twist. The history of one of America's most iconic foods, beverages really, is uniquely intertwined with American history itself. According to our guest, the beverage is bourbon. While the name may sound, a bit French, the Bourbon Dynasty there, there's not much French about it. Probably the most closely associated with the American frontier, Kentucky in particular, the corn-based barrel-aged spirit is American all the way. Well, we've got Dane Hucklebridge with us now. He's got a new book out on bourbon. It's called Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. Dane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it was fascinating to read in your book, early colonial days, all the hardships, far from home, and one of the main complaints colonists had was, we don't have good booze here. And that's that's what led them to turn corn into alcohol in the first place. What were some of the first steps there?
Sure. Well, I mean, what you had was, in those very early colonial days, the first English settlers, they really did not like to drink water. And, you know, with bitter reason, in hindsight, they thought it was poisonous. And it was because so often, you know, people would drink from polluted water sources and get sick from it. So they, in that period in time amongst Englishmen, they really avoided water as a drink. So as a substitute, they drank lots of alcoholic beverages, both higher in alcohol and lower in alcohol. The problem being, when they came to Virginia, suddenly that was a really long beer run crossing the Atlantic. So they had to figure out a way to start producing their own alcoholic beverages locally. And that's really, you know, since they didn't really have that much barley and it didn't grow well, they started like looking into making alcohol from native grains, one of which was corn. And that's really those very early days in Virginia when you first start seeing alcohol being made from corn, which is the basis of bourbon whiskey.
So 1620 or so is where you attribute the birth of bourbon. Some purists disagree. Would a modern-day bourbon drinker tasting that early corn alcohol recognize it as bourbon?
Well, probably not, because under most circumstances it would not have been aged. I mean, if it would have been aged back then, it probably would have happened so by accident. So if it just so happened that you had some very early colonial whiskey that had been forgotten about or left to sit for and spend some time in a barrel, then in that case, I think it's possible it would be recognizable as something, if not bourbon, relatively close. But for most of that period, they weren't really aging their whiskey. It would have been consumed, you know, almost immediately when it's still clear right out of the still.
These guys couldn't wait.
Yeah, they just couldn't wait. It was a hard life. They needed a drink, I guess.
Now, they weren't calling it bourbon then. Where and when did that name come about?
Sure. Well, as you know, I mean, bourbon, it comes from Bourbon, Kentucky, this region. And today, you know, Bourbon County is a very small county, and they don't even make any whiskey there, to my knowledge. But once upon a time, it was much larger. And there was a whole big region of sort of central and eastern Kentucky that was referred to as the Bourbon Region or Bourbon County. And that took its name from, you know, the Bourbon Dynasty from France. And right after the Revolution, when all of that land was opening up for settlement, people had a lot of gratitude to the French for helping us win the war with England. So you see a lot of French names in that area, one of which is this Bourbon County, this Bourbon region, and they started making corn whiskey. And probably, you know, they first started making the whiskey in the late 1700s. I think the first real mention of it in print anyway, being called bourbon whiskey, is 1820. That was around there anyway. That was a little bit of an anomaly. But by the 1840s, 1850s, the name has definitely caught on. And by the time of the Civil War, you know, this bourbon whiskey was known both north and south throughout America.
And by the end of the Civil War, it was popular enough that people were making fake bourbon or selling not bourbon as bourbon. And it ended up causing a major scandal in American politics. Tell us about that.
Indeed. Well, you know, that area, that time after the Civil War, the Gilded Age, was just set by all manner of corporate greed and corruption. And, you know, the whiskey was not exempt. There was quite a bit of corruption in whiskey, both literally, in that a lot of distilleries outside of Kentucky in particular were turning out very low quality sort of fake whiskey, fake bourbon, and trying to sell it as bourbon. But also, even, you know, the bigger scope, there was a lot of government corruption. There was the whiskey ring I mentioned in the book. There was this. So basically, the distillers, some of these unscrupulous distillers and politicians, were in cahoots, and they weren't paying the taxes they should have been on this low-quality bourbon, and, you know, they weren't reporting it, and they were bribing the government officials. And this scandal ended up going all the way, you know, all the way to the White House, potentially all the way up to Grant, and that's it was a big kind of black eye for America and the whiskey industry.
And moving ahead to the 1890s, another war, not really a literal war, I don't think, a whiskey war, mainly in Kentucky, between established producers and others. What was the whiskey war, and what was the outcome?
Well, in a way, yeah, that was a direct offshoot of what I mentioned. You had the more traditional bourbon distilleries in Kentucky who still made their product, you know, purely from their mash bill, their corn, aged it in charred oak barrels and let it sit there for through the years and turned out, you know, a more high quality, authentic product. And then scattered mostly outside Kentucky in a lot in cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati and New Orleans as well, you had other distillers who were essentially just trying to make a quick buck turning out fake bourbon. They would just take grain alcohol and dye it and add flavorings and other unsavory chemicals to try to make it imitate that aging process. And that's what caused this conflict, was that the bourbon makers in Kentucky really resented the fact that these people outside of the region were giving their whiskey a bad name by turning out this sort of fake product. And that eventually culminated in the Bottle and Bond Act, which is 1897, I believe, and then the Pure Food and Drug Act a little less than 10 years later, which finally, you know, set that standard. The government finally, you know, got its act together and made a clear definition of what real bourbon was.
So now we get a legal definition for bourbon, and not too long after, bourbon and most other booze is illegal. How did Prohibition affect the bourbon industry?
Yeah, it's ironic, but it's true. And It's interesting. Prohibition, I think, on a cultural level, bourbon and, you know, the jazz age, the lost generation, they're very intertwined. So, bourbon definitely kind of put a fire and put some music in that age. But in terms of the effect it had on the industry, it was disastrous. And the only way that distilleries could stay in business was if they got a medicinal permit, because you could still get whiskey with a doctor's prescription. And very few, you know, only a handful of Kentucky distillers ever were able to get those permits. So quite a few distilleries went out of business. You had all manner of corruption and organized crime that was trying to get their hands on these sort of government-controlled stores of whiskey and get it up to speakeasies. And it was just kind of a nasty time. And it really took the whiskey industry, the bourbon industry, a long time to recover. Because even what happened was when Prohibition was lifted, they hadn't been making whiskey in over a decade, really. So you didn't have, you know, and whiskey has to sit in barrels to age, so there was no aged whiskey to sell. So they had to really figure out ways to start turning a profit, and you start getting lower quality bourbon. And that went right into the World War II shortly after, when the whiskey industry again had to quit making bourbon to help the war effort. So I think there was a really tough few decades right after right after Prohibition that put a real dent in the bourbon industry.
We've got these Kentucky bourbon companies. Jim Beam is one that pops to mind. You write that for the most part, they haven't been owned by people in Kentucky for a long time. Chicago investors, and this year, Japanese company taking over. Does that affect the bourbon that America is drinking?
Well, it's funny. I think it, you know, the bourbon industry, there's some truth behind it, but generally, you know, part of marketing is oftentimes projecting like a real authentic Americana heritage ideal, which is true in some ways, but also bourbon, just like America, has become a big corporate global enterprise. So, you know, it's quite a few of the, you know, distilleries are owned by larger conglomerates, international companies and whatnot. So, you know, it's a little bit of a myth that bourbon is this kind of old-timey, you know, log cabin and racehorse type thing. It's a modern big business.
I just wanted to ask before we're done, at the other end of the spectrum, we've got a micro distillery movement making lots of vodkas and gins and things like that. Is it harder to break into bourbon because of the aging issue?
Well, actually it is. I mean, that's what I find especially fascinating about the bourbon landscape at the moment, is you have these traditional big distilleries, but then there's this whole new batch of small craft distilleries popping up. And it is true that it's tough to break into, specifically because you have to wait so long to start turning a profit. And that's why many smaller craft distilleries that make bourbon, oftentimes they start out making an unaged spirit like vodka or gin, you know, to start turning money while their first batch is aging, or in some cases other tricks like using smaller barrels, which tend to age the whiskey a little quicker, or buying, you know, aged spirits from other distilleries and blending them themselves. You know, there's certain things they can do, but it definitely is hard.
Dane, got to ask, how do you take your bourbon?
I I like it neat. I like a neat glass of bourbon. I'm not too picky, but, you know, I won't turn down the good stuff.
I go neat usually, or it makes a fine Manhattan. Do you have a brand or two that you're recommending lately?
Ooh, you always hear about Pappy Van Winkle, and it's great stuff if you can find it and afford it, which I oftentimes have trouble with both. But, there's a lot of good stuff out there. Blanton's I like, Booker's, Weller. It's, there's a ton of good stuff out there. And, really, you drink what you like. So if you enjoy it, I say drink it.
Dane, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Dane Hucklebridge. His new book is Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit.
And I ain't had enough. Need me a triple shot of that stuff. Gonna get drunk, won't you listen right here?